From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today is Ash Wednesday. More protests around the country. We'll speak with Father Dan Berrigan about why he plans to get arrested today. It's also the first anniversary of his brother Phil Berrigan's arrest. We'll find out why he's currently in solitary confinement. Also, a tale of two soldiers, a Vietnam-era veteran and a former Iraqi soldier, discuss their lives. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Despite U.S. concerns about his newly minted agreement with Iraq, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan is turning his attention to appointing a team of diplomats to join inspections of the most sensitive suspected weapon sites in Iraq. Annan has given no hint about who will be on the team or who will lead it, two key questions Washington wants answered before it gives its full backing to Annan's accord. Russia's U.N. Ambassador Sergei Lavrov said he was certain Annan would balance the nationalities of the senior diplomats since Iraq has complained that U.N. inspection teams were dominated by Britons and Americans. In Washington, Secretary of State Madeleine Albright declared that U.N. inspectors and not diplomats would have the ultimate say in where and when inspections are made. American U.N. Ambassador Bill Richardson also warned that Iraq could use some of the ambiguities in the accord to its advantage. He said, "Our concern is Saddam Hussein and whether he will find loopholes in some of the ambiguities." The United States and Britain have also called for a quick test of the agreement to expose the sites to inspectors. It wasn't clear when or how such a test would come. 20 Italian pacifists who came to Baghdad as voluntary human shields in case of U.S.-led military attacks said today they're staying in Baghdad to deter future threats of force. Fabio Alberti, president of Bridge to Baghdad Association, said the United States has decided to attack this country anyway. If it is not now, it will be tomorrow. Alberti said the group would stay for a week in Baghdad, but had another team of 34 volunteers ready to come and place themselves at possible targets of U.S. bombing. U.S. Marines joined a buildup of American military might in Kuwait today, saying they're ready for action in case a U.N.-brokered agreement with Iraq on arms inspections breaks down. More than 200 Marines from the 2,100-strong 24th Marine Expeditionary Unit landed by military hovercraft in Kuwait City's Shwake port and headed to the desert for live-fire training. This news here at home. Yesterday, in a day that laid bare the depths of animosity between the White House and the Independent Counsel, Kenneth Starr summoned a parade of witnesses to the federal courthouse, including a senior White House aide who's attacked the Starr probe and a private investigator who's been working on the case for Clinton's legal team. At the same time, Starr sought testimony from former Lewinsky co-workers who might be able to shed light on how she moved from an unpaid internship to a paid White House job in late 1995 and what led to her abrupt and involuntary transfer to the Pentagon 6 months later. Prosecutors are examining that career path for clues to whether she had a sexual relationship with President Clinton, despite his denial. Campaign finance legislation has survived a Republican attempt to kill it in a 51-48 vote, but backers lack the 60 votes needed to clear the way for passage. Democrats lined up behind a compromise on disclosing funding for so-called issue ads in a bid to fend off a GOP amendment curbing use of union dues for political aims. The top executives of the major tobacco companies told a Senate panel yesterday that they would never agree to modify their advertising and marketing practices unless lawmakers gave the industry substantial protection against lawsuits. Danny Yatom resigned as the head of the Mossad, Israel's intelligence agency. He was adamant that he had been unfairly criticized by a government commission investigating an attempt to assassinate the political leader of the militant organization Hamas in Amman. King Hussein of Jordan had reportedly said he would not resume his country's cooperation with Israeli intelligence services as long as Yatom was in office. That report did not apologize for the attempted assassination. Kim Dae-jung, a lifelong dissident, was inaugurated as president in South Korea's first peaceful transfer of power from one ruler to an opposition party. He immediately called for an exchange of envoys with North Korea, a possible summit meeting, family reunions, and private exchanges. And China has offered to resume discussions on the future of Taiwan, which it regards as a rebel province and which it's threatened to retake by military force. A Taiwan official called the invitation positive and acknowledged that his government was under increasing American pressure to renew contacts with Beijing. And finally, a leader in Arab and Islamic affairs in the U.S. has died. Mohammed Mehdi was 70 years old. A colleague says he died Monday of a heart attack in New York City. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
The drums of war.
That's why you have military to fight.
The job of leadership is to prepare them for it. It wouldn't take nearly as many troops as it would last time.
Now, if they come up with some solution, is that in our national interest?
Getting rid of Saddam.
At Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, we dance to a different drummer.
Yeah. What is good for? Absolutely nothing.
Uh-huh. Virtually the entire world is either pleading, urging, or warning us not to go to war with Iraq.
See, we never expected from a great country, superpower like America, to bombard a shelter.
Good God, y'all.
What is good for?
Absolutely nothing. Get said again.
And you are listening to Democracy Now!'s War and Peace Report. Today is Ash Wednesday. 1 year ago today, anti-war activist Philip Berrigan hammered on a nuclear destroyer in Bath, Maine. During his trial, he cited the U.S. sanctions on Iraq and the Gulf War as United States war crimes. Following the trial, Berrigan was sentenced to 2 years in federal prison. Today, Philip Berrigan enters his 10th day of solitary confinement in Petersburg Federal Prison in Virginia. This following the arrest of former Nobel Peace Prize winner Mairead Corrigan at the prison last Monday. Corrigan nominated Philip Berrigan and his brother Daniel for the Nobel Peace Prize earlier this year. She was arrested after refusing to leave the Virginia prison following a visit with Berrigan. Corrigan said she was protesting his incarceration. Following her arrest, Corrigan was taken to a local jail where she was held for 26 hours before being released without charges. Philip Berrigan was placed in solitary confinement after refusing to sign a statement saying he didn't support Corrigan's action. Philip Berrigan has spent nearly 10 years in prison during his lifetime. Today we're joined by Father Daniel Berrigan. Father Berrigan will be commemorating the anniversary of his brother's incarceration by engaging in civil disobedience today at the U.S. mission to the United Nations in protest of the U.S. sanctions and the continued military buildup in the Gulf. And we welcome you to Democracy Now!, Father Berrigan.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what you will be doing today?
Well, the scenario is very simple, and we've followed it, of course, for a number of years here in New York City. We're starting with the ceremony of ashes in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral this morning. People are going to burn documents that they would like to get rid of symbolically from their lives. And we'll anoint one another with the ashes on the forehead and then proceed down to the U.S. mission, just with leafleting and, you know, the usual parade, trying to get some sanity into this manic scene of the destruction of another country to no avail. But that's about it.
Well, while the United States says it has a lot of questions about the pact that Kofi Annan signed with the deputy prime minister of Iraq, Tariq Aziz,
right,
the fact is the U.N. Security Council will be signing this agreement. Many think that the protests will go away now.
Well, many are entitled to think what many usually think, and that's the same line. The fact is that this enormous military buildup continues. There's very sound reason to believe that despite any kind of diplomatic agreement, Mr. Clinton is determined to go ahead at some point. So it's very important to keep the heat on.
Well, Father Dan Berrigan, we have a message for you from California that was called into our comment line.
Uh-huh.
Hello, this is a message for Father Daniel Berrigan from the San Francisco, actually Oakland area. I'd like to let him know greetings from us and that 50 members of the Religious Peace and Justice community gathered at the Oakland Federal Building last Tuesday, and 11 of us were arrested, and we send our greetings and best wishes for him in his arrests. And how many ways can he spell Skillebex? Bye-bye.
Do you get that?
Very nice. Thank good friends out there. Great.
Well, Father Dan Berrigan, what about Phil Berrigan's incarceration, the fact that he is serving a 2-year sentence for hammering on a nuclear warhead in Bath, Maine, and now is currently in solitary confinement? You visited him this weekend.
Yes, I was down there, and it should be mentioned that 3 of the 6 who acted there in Bath are still in prison, and we want to honor their names today, too, Stephen Kelly and Susan Crane in California and Philip. Elizabeth, Phil's wife, and I went there on Saturday morning and were admitted finally, and were astonished to see a paper on a table in the visiting room marked for visitors of those in solitary confinement. And we said to the guard, "What is this all about?" And he shrugged and said he knew nothing. That was our first inkling that something had happened. Anyway, it developed that within a half hour after he went back to prison population on a week ago Monday, the guards came, handcuffed him, and led him off to solitary. And when he tried to find out what was up, they thrust a paper at him, telling him that he was to sign that for the security of the institution, which is quite a thing to give my brother. And the purport of the paper was that he did not agree with what Ms. Corrigan had done in sitting in, and that it was her initiative entirely, and so on and so forth. And he simply said, "That's a lie. I told her to follow her conscience, and that would be fine. And you'll get no signature from me." At that point, it became clear that he was in trouble. So we've gotten the ACLU of Virginia interested in the case. They're rumbling away down there. We have notified various friends, lawyer friends. Ramsey Clark in New York City sent a fax and a phone call. And so they're going to have to say why he's in there. And we publicize whatever charges they're going to bring, or they're going to release him into prison population.
Explain exactly what he did, the hammering on the Aegis destroyer.
Well, 6 of them went into this huge naval bath ironworks in Maine, and they poured their blood around a lot of this technology. This is a nuclear-capable ship, which can also wage biological and chemical warfare. It casts a certain ironic light on this business about getting the knowledge of Hussein's weaponry when we're developing new weaponry of the same type. That's it. They poured their blood around, and they had household hammers in accord with the dictum of Isaiah, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares," and they were arrested, and the rest we're familiar with.
We're talking to Father Dan Berrigan, a Jesuit priest, peace activist, and author of more than 50 books, including No Bars to Manhood, The Trial of the Catonsville Nine, and most recently Ezekiel. In fact, we're coming up on the 30th anniversary of the trial of the Catonsville Nine, which Dan Berrigan was involved with, along with his brother, among the first burning of draft cards in this country. We're also joined by Art Laffin, who is with Voices in the Wilderness, the group we've been hearing from every day from Baghdad, Iraq. And this is a Chicago-based human rights group that is challenging the embargo against Iraq. We've been talking to Kathy Kelly, and one day, though, we also did speak to Art Laffin in Baghdad, but he has just returned. He's author of Swords into Plowshares, which is a history of nonviolent resistance from 1980 to 1997. It's nice to have you back safely in the studio, Art Laffin. Art Laffin has come up from Washington, D.C. to participate in today's Ash Wednesday protest that Father Dan Berrigan will be leading. What are your thoughts today on Iraq, where you have just come from?
Well, it's great to be here, and Kathy Kelly and Chuck Quilty and Rick McDowell from our delegation still remain in Baghdad. I've had a hard time sleeping the last 4 days since I've been back, because I continue to see the horror of what I experienced. It's one thing to know that over a million people have died as a result of sanctions, including over 700,000 children. It's another thing to actually see children dying before your eyes. It's another thing to see a mother crying, weeping, mourning the imminent loss of her child. Because of the indiscriminate weapon that continues to be used against the people of Iraq, which are the sanctions.
But how is the child actually dying?
Well, I had an opportunity with my friends to go into about four hospitals. And one person, a 7-month-old baby that we saw, her name is Zara. She has acute marasmus, which is a protein deficiency. And this little child was malnourished and so deformed and in great anguish, and looking into her eyes and just seeing this child, which I thought immediately of my nephews and nieces and the children that I live with at the Dorothy Day House Catholic Worker in Washington, to look into this child's eyes and see that this child is going to die because of malnutrition is an unspeakable crime. And I had the same experience with another young girl, 11 years old, Kafar, her name is. She has second-stage lymphoma, which if she were here in the States, you know, she could be treated and eventually get well. But because of the lack of medicines, the doctors say that they have only about 10% of the medicine and medical supplies they need to treat those who are sick and dying. This 11-year-old girl, Kafar, will probably die. And so these are real people. These are our sisters and brothers, you know. And I had another experience in Basra where I saw a 7-year-old girl named Anne. And when she was 53 days old, she was injected with a dirty needle. There were some tests being done. And needles are there's a great shortage of these hypodermic needles in the hospitals. Anyway, she was injected with this dirty needle, and as a consequence of that, she's become paralyzed, and her nervous condition has been affected, and she can't move. And she sits there with the help of her mother and father taking care of her, and it's just an unspeakable crime to witness this. She's a casualty of the sanctions.
Art Laffin, do you feel any relief about this accord that has been reached between the United Nations and Iraq?
Well, I think we all feel, a very slight relief. However, the buildup continues, and as Father Dan Berrigan just said, the administration intends to use these weapons. There's an intent here to bomb Iraq into submission at some point along the way. It's been stated, but every person that we spoke with said that the greatest weapon that continues to be unleashed against the people of Iraq are the sanctions. And until these sanctions are lifted, there can be no peace and stability in the region.
Father Dan Berrigan, what is the attitude of the Catholic Church? This protest today is on Ash Wednesday. Your brother's protest a year ago, also on Ash Wednesday.
Right. Well, officially there's been a minority of the Catholic bishops very strongly against the sanctions and the buildup and the threat of war itself. I think about 55 of the bishops have signed a strong statement to the president in that regard. This is something new, and we're, remotely encouraged by that. But the lead has always been from people like ourselves who have no power in the church and who hope that the powerful will follow.
And so today you and Art Laffin and many other people, Pax Christi, Catholic Worker, and other groups will go to St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York City and then march over to the U.S. mission to the United Nations?
Right. And there we'll try to talk to somebody, try to get some sense in the air, and if nothing else occurs, I suppose they'll pick us up.
Well, yes?
That's the usual scenario.
Well, we hope we won't be speaking to you from prison as we have been speaking to your brother from prison over the last year.
Thank you.
Father Dan Berrigan joining us from New York City, and Art Laffin just returned from Baghdad with the Voices in the Wilderness delegation. He is author of Swords into Plowshares, Nonviolent Direct Action for Disarmament. If you'd like to get a copy of this book, which is published by Rosehill Fourth Camp Publishers, you can call 1-800-43-PEACE. That's 1-800-43-PEACE. When we come back, we'll hear about some other actions around the country, and then we'll hear a tale of two soldiers, one a former Iraqi soldier, and then we'll hear from a Vietnam-era veteran talking about what it means to have 25,000 soldiers from the United States in the Gulf right now. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
I was standing by my window on a cold and cloudy day when I saw that horse we rode in. It was taking my sister away. Said, "Undertaker, Undertaker, won't you please drive real slow? That's my will. Baby sister, Lord, I sure hate to see her go. Will the circle be unbroken by and by, Lord, by and by? There's a battle
This is Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, protests continue around the country. In fact, today, after the event in New York City at the U.S. mission to the United Nations, where there'll be a civil disobedience, Art Laffin, who we were just talking to, is headed down to Washington, where he will be with others tonight around 6 and 7 in front of the White House, and they, too, will be risking arrest. Let's hear from some other listeners who've called in from around the country with events that they are involved with.
This is a report from Nevada City, California. Activists last week formed Community for Peace and Justice. The contact phone number is 530-265-3696. Last Friday evening, that was February 20th, we had a candlelight vigil. About 100 people attended. It was covered on two of the network affiliates in Sacramento. UUtah Phillips spoke. Cool Hand Uke sang us a brand new song, and we had a candlelight march through town. Sunday, we crashed the Mardi Gras parade in front of some 6,000-7,000 people. A lot of people actually joined us. We got a rousing of response, and our big hit is a sign, our direction to Bill Clinton, to make love to Hillary, not war on Iraq. And things are progressing. Bye.
Hi, this is Diana Hershey. I'm in Salt Lake City, Utah. I'm with the Committee for Peace in the Middle East, a newly formed committee here in Salt Lake City. We put together a protest demonstration last Friday at our federal building. We had about 150 people show up. We got not very good coverage on TV. We got one good piece of coverage in our local newspaper, one of our local newspapers. We have another big action plan for next Saturday, February the 28th at noon in our federal building. We are planning a nonviolence training also coming up. So we're here and working hard in Salt Lake City and happy to be part of the worldwide protest. Our slogan is end the sanctions, don't bomb the Iraqi people. Thanks a lot for a great, great program. I picked it up over your local affiliate, KRCL, here in Salt Lake City. Bye-bye.
And we want to welcome the listeners to KRCL, to Democracy Now! KRCL in Salt Lake City just started running Democracy Now! On Monday. And you can tell your friends around the country who may not be able to hear Democracy Now! That they, too, can call their public radio stations, and we can be broadcast weekdays. By the way, we've been asking for peace activist sightings on the corporate media, particularly in the corporate news network programs on ABC, CBS, CNN, and PBS. And we haven't quite seen one yet. Well, not exactly. We did make a peace activist sighting yesterday, and it was us. That's right, folks. CNN did a story on peace activists and journalists in this country. And we want to thank Maria Hinojosa for that, who is a CNN reporter. It was the first time, actually, we saw peace activists not only in protest, but actually being interviewed. They came to the studios at Pacifica Station WBAI on Monday. They recorded what we were doing, and they broadcast it yesterday. Also interviewed Ramsey Clark, the former U.S. Attorney General. As he said, we have to push this country on an honorable path. Well, right now, we're going to turn to a related issue with more than 25,000 U.S. troops and hundreds of warplanes in the Gulf remaining on alert despite this week's peace deal between U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan and Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Indeed, often overlooked in the cacophony of sound surrounding the Iraq crisis has been the men and women who'd fight battles and suffer the consequences in a very direct way. Today on Democracy Now!, a special look at soldiers, both Iraqi and American. We're joined by Rahman. He is a former Iraqi soldier. He is a high school teacher of English literature, originally from the town of Babylon, which is 60 miles south of Baghdad. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Well, thank you, Amy.
You have quite an interesting history, and if I was wondering if you could tell us now, joining us from Albuquerque today, about that history. You were an Iraqi soldier. When?
Well, after I graduated from Baghdad University in 1988, I drafted to the Army, and I joined to the Army from 88 until 1990, which is August 2nd. After the Iraq invaded Kuwait, I deserted the Army.
Why did you desert?
Well, as most of the Iraqis, they don't believe in the war. And the invasion for Kuwait, we didn't believe in that one. So I thought, it is not who I am to go to war. I don't believe in war. So this is the reason I deserted.
And what did it mean for you to desert from the Iraqi army? Where did you go?
Well, it means I should face the sequence in Iraq, which that means going to jail or executed or whatever is going to be. But I went to my uncle farm, which is in the countryside, far away from the government and their security or intelligence.
And so they didn't find you?
They didn't find me until... I mean, they didn't find me. They didn't catch me. That was easy.
Now, just after the Persian Gulf War, the U.S. called for people of Iraq to rise up against Saddam Hussein. In fact, there were uprisings. In the north, the Kurds rose up, and in the south, the Shiites rose up against Saddam Hussein. The U.S. did not support either uprising. Were you involved in the southern uprising?
Well, yeah, I was part of that uprising. And, you know, we get promises from the former president, George Bush, and King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, if you are going to arise against Saddam Hussein, we will help you. And we answered that call. We did fight very hard in the south, from Babylon till Basra, which is the Basra is the capital of the south of Iraq, which is, we fight very hard. You know, they told us we will get help. We are just poor people. There is nothing. Just we have our guns, which is we took it from the army after they left Kuwait. And to facing the Iraqi army, it is one of the most difficult mission for Boer people. Iraqi army was strong at that time, was fighting 33 countries together under the umbrella of United Nations. We left alone, and we had no choice just to die or to find another place. So what they did, they opened the border with Saudi Arabia, and most people went to Saudi Arabia.
You know, it's something that I think a lot of people in this country don't remember. After President Bush called on Iraqis to rise up, the fact is that when the Southern Uprising happened, and there was a no-fly zone, so Saddam Hussein wouldn't be able to fly into southern Iraq to put down the uprising, the U.S. lifted that no-fly zone and said they didn't want to get involved with domestic activities, and so Saddam Hussein was able to send helicopters in and kill the people who rose up.
That's right, because we have not covered. I mean, the Iraqi helicopter was bombing the rebels, bombing the houses, and we can't see the American helicopter is in the same area. And actually, they give them the cover. They don't shoot them down or at least be there for us, as they promised.
I'm wondering, I just had a conversation about a week ago with an Iraqi American who was saying that he believes the U.S. has never wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein as proof after the Persian Gulf War, the uprisings not being supported in either the north or the south of Iraq by the U.S. and giving other reasons that they don't want to see a democracy in Iraq. What is your thought about that?
Well, I think the Americans, they want Saddam Hussein there. They want him very weak. As President Clinton said before, I want to put him in a box. But they want him to take their stake, I mean, to use the stake against other neighbor, and plus building up a military in that area. And, you know, we don't believe they want to take him or to just take Saddam Hussein out of the power in Iraq. Most Iraqi people, they don't believe that. And that the reason most of the Iraqi maybe support Saddam Hussein, because they feel, oh, the Americans support him. Why we don't?
Again, we're talking with Rahman, who is a former Iraqi soldier. He deserted just before the Persian Gulf War, was part of the Southern Uprising against Saddam Hussein. But when that was put down, went into Saudi Arabia. What was the Persian Gulf attack like when the U.S. planes bombed Iraq?
Well, it is really hard to imagine right now. I mean, you know, dead people everywhere, school destroyed, hospitals, people, they lost the hope. You know, you're sleeping in your house, you imagine you are going to die or there's no tomorrow.
And yet the...
You know,
Go ahead.
You know, you see the kids in the street, no shelter, nobody tell them what is that. They thought it is just a game to play. It is hard. I mean, it is hard to see the airplane playing, bombing the bridge. One of the bridges in the town of Nasiriyah, they bombed and then they killed 500 people. They are not a military people. They are not a soldier. And this is the war. The powder, you can smell the powder everywhere in Iraq. Small towns, big towns, soldier died, civilian died. Everybody is facing the death there. And so there is no hope.
And yet we were told during the Persian Gulf War that with the U.S.'s smart bombs that they mainly hit the targets they were going for, and they were military targets, though afterwards we learned that I believe a majority of those targets actually were not hit and that many civilians died.
Well, one of those smart bombs hit Al-Amiriya shelter and killed 300 people there. And it is just shelter. And, you know, people get boiled in the water there after they hit. Is this the smart bomb to hit a shelter, civilian shelter? People just left their houses to go to this place to be safe. I don't know if there is really the smart bomb or whatever they call it.
Rahman, what do you think is the strategy that should be used now in the Persian Gulf? What do you think would be best for Iraq and the people of Iraq?
Well, I think the best thing, sanction lift, let the Iraqi eat right now, and then after they eat, after they get their health take care of, and then it's time to speak for people to uprising again against Saddam Hussein. If I don't find my food, if I don't support my family with their needs, I'm not going to uprising. I'm not going to be against the government. The government, you know, control everything in Iraq. They control the food. They control electricity. Even you can't go to the hospital if you have somebody in the Iraqi opposition against Saddam. So if we need the Iraqi people to get back in their roles, we should lift the sanction first and let Iraqi think after that what they are going to do with Saddam Hussein. Iraqi opposing Saddam Hussein is still there, still in the marshland, in the south, still in the Kurdish place, and still in Baghdad and everywhere. But their priority right now is to get food for their families.
It's interesting hearing from Iraqi dissidents around the world. It sounds like a uniform voice for the U.S. not to strike Iraq and to lift the sanctions.
Well, striking Iraq really doesn't solve anything. More people dying, more hatred. Here, I'm in the United States and they're in Iraq. I mean, the last time when Iraqi army attacked the Kurdish in the north, what the U.S. did, they bombed in the south Iraq, which is 1,000 miles from the Kurdish place. So people asking, okay, if the army attacking in the north and they want the army to get back to their bases, why they hit in the south? There is nothing in the south.
Rahman, I wanted to ask you about what happened to you after you and your family went to Saudi Arabia. You were taken as prisoners of war?
Well, actually, I just myself, but there is a lot of family. You know, when I arrived, there is a checkpoint between Basra and Nasiriyah, which both big towns in the south of Iraq. And there is a checkpoint, and it is stopped the car we were. And then they asked us about our ID. And, you know, I was speaking English at that time. Not that English, but it is okay. And I say, you know, I'm not a soldier. Why are you taking me? And they say, okay, everybody who has ID or even his ID, you know, in Iraq we don't have ID. When we are in the army, we are a soldier, so we have the soldier ID. And they say, oh, you are a soldier. I say, but I'm not fighting. And the ceasefire took place like a month ago, so there is no fighting. There is no prisoner of war. And you say, okay, you are a prisoner of war right now. And they say, why? I didn't fight. You know, I didn't believe in the war. And this is why I deserve the army. And you're giving me this identity? I refuse to be a prisoner of war. And then, you know, nobody even talked to us. Just they put us in a tent and waiting to transfer to inside Saudi Arabia. And then we took like a month to see the first Red Cross representative. Go
ahead, you asked.
And I asked this person, why am I a prisoner of war? I'm not. And he said, you know, you have two choices. You are with the Shiite revolutionary people in the south, and right now you have two choices, to be prisoner of war or to be deported again to the Iraqi border and then to Saddam Hussein, to face the death or to be a prisoner of war. And, you know, I have no choices in this. I just choose to be a prisoner of war.
We have to break, but when we come back, I'd like to ask you how you ended up in the United States, how you ended up in Albuquerque, where we're speaking to you today. And then we're going to go to a U.S. Vietnam-era veteran to talk about the fate of U.S. veterans. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. We'll be back in a minute.
The First World War, it came and it went, and the reason for fighting I never did get. But I learned to accept it, accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. In the 1960s came the Vietnam War. Can someone tell me what we were fighting for? So many young men died, so many mothers cried. Now I ask the question, was God on our side?
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. It's wrapping up with Rahman, a former Iraqi soldier. We won't use his whole name. And he is now in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You were a prisoner of war in Saudi Arabia for how many years?
Well, I stayed there 4 years.
And how did you end up in the United States?
Actually, after 2 months when we were in the prison at that time, we have a protest against the Saudi, and we called to United Nations to open office there. We want to contact our families. We want to contact the whole world and to tell them what our story. And, you know, even this uprising, the Saudi, they don't understand that we are protest for peace. We want to call our family. We want to know something. And, you know, they opened the fire on us. They killed like 85 people, injured I think 100 at that time.
This is the Saudi government that the U.S.
This
supports.
Is the Saudi government, yeah. And after that,
they opened fire, you know, on you?
Yeah, they opened the fire, you know. And we were, when I say it is a prison, it is just a tent in the Saudi desert. I mean, it is not rooms. It is not building. It is just a tent. And, you know, a soldier just opened the fire. So there is no way to avoid the fire. You know, just hold each other and we pray. Because who is going to die, we don't know. And actually the bullet may be killing 3-4 people because they use really heavy arm. It is not that personal gun. And after that, you know, nobody covered that for the media. Then they a representative from Red Cross came to the camp, and we talked to him, and we say we need a United Nations office here. And they promised us, oh, it is okay, and after 2-3 months, they opened the office there. And, you know, they start talking about resettlement for the Iraqi refugees in different countries. We ask for to call all the embassies in Saudi Arabia. Nobody answered us. And until I think a year and a half, and then they say, okay, we are going to interview every refugees or prisoner of war in this camp, and with those files and ready for the United Nations or the delegations coming to pick or select some people.
And so people went to Scandinavia, they went to Canada, and you went to the United States?
And Iran and some other countries.
Are you a Shiite Muslim?
I'm a Shiite Muslim.
You went to Albuquerque, and actually we learned about you because you were among a group of Iraqis who were in Albuquerque joining with people in the New Mexico area protesting the U.S. strike against Iraq.
Well, we are a small group here, and, you know, the American people, they just know about Iraq and the Iraqis through Saddam Hussein and through the media. And we want to just tell the American people, Saddam Hussein is not the Iraqi people. If you want to listen for the Iraqi people, just we are talking about that. And Iraqi people is not that picture it showed in the American media that Iraq is burning the American flags and the Israelis and they have anti-American people or whatever they call them. That's not the Iraqi people. We just want to tell the story, just show the other face of the story, show that kids are dying there, show that's, and you know, I mean, even I don't really believe in this demonstration in Baghdad. I was in the university, as I told you before. If they want any demonstration, you know, they surrounded our university with military, and they took us, they give us the sign, and just show the sign. And I can say, I'm not surprised if I see my mom holding one of those pictures or burning the American flag, because they forced her. Mm. They forced everybody to go to the uprising. And I don't know how to tell the media here, how to tell the people. Guys, Iraqi are not what you see in the TV.
Well, I want to thank you for giving us a human face to people who have been so demonized in the U.S. media and by the U.S. government. Again, we have been speaking with Rahman, former Iraqi soldier who deserted, was a high school teacher of English literature, originally from the town of Babylon in Iraq, 60 miles south of Baghdad, now in Albuquerque, New Mexico. We learned of you through Peace with Iraq, which is the name of the peace group in Albuquerque, and their number is 505-246-9229. And I understand that Saturday at noon, there will be a protest to end the sanctions against Iraq, calling for U.S. military out of the Gulf. It's a demonstration that's going to be taking place at the Uptown Shopping Mall at the corner of Louisiana and Manal, and that's Saturday at noon in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The number again to call is 505-246-9229. That's 505-246-9229. And Rahman, will you be there on Saturday at the protest?
I will be there, and I will ready to answer any question about Iraqi people. I'm just individual, and so all my information is just my story, and it is a real story in Iraq. So welcome for everybody to join us, to ask us. I mean, don't sympathize with us. Just get the fact from us.
Well, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll take a short music break and then come back to U.S. Vietnam-era veteran and talk about soldiers in this country.
Never made, and they're afraid that I'm afraid.
Phil Oakes singing The War Is Over, written before the Vietnam War had officially ended. It was a message to those whose resistance would end with the war and a tribute to the power of unified action and continued struggle beyond the Vietnam War from Phil Oakes's Farewells and Fantasies, a 3CD box set from Elektra Records. Well, we turn now from a former Iraqi soldier to a Vietnam-era veteran. Stephen Williams joins us in our studio in New York. Stephen Williams is Deputy Director of Black Veterans for Social Justice, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. How you feel?
Good. There are more than 25,000 U.S. soldiers in the Gulf right now, so it's hard to think about the fact that the crisis is over. What do you think's happening with those people right now?
From my experience, I would believe that you have some young people, and I would like to add that there are many women as well as men now with the new military that are under severe stress, frustration, aggravation, missing their loved ones. I remember a time when I was in the military when we were put on alert and we were put in trucks and we were put on an airstrip. We weren't given any information at all. But I could remember the great feeling of apprehension, you know, what is going to happen to me now? And that's sometimes just as bad as actually going to war.
When Persian Gulf veterans came back to the United States, there were parades and parties all over this country. In New York, there was a large ticker tape parade down Broadway. Were you there?
Yes, I was. And at the end of the parade, I remember going back into my office and having about five or six Persian Gulf veterans coming to me telling me they had nowhere to stay that night, they had no food and nowhere to change their clothes, and they were looking at going to a shelter. They were scared, apprehensive, and they didn't know what to do. I mean, they had this big rush of being welcomed back home, and then after the rush and after the fanfare, there was nothing left. And I was listening earlier, and the gentleman was talking about looking at the children die, and that's one front, but there's another front, the horrors of war after the war. I mean, the war is over, but there are still battles. In Vietnam, they had a term called missing in action. Well, we have another term, it's called missing in America. Vietnam combat vets, Persian Gulf vets, these people are actually missing in America. You can walk up 34th Street and see people trying to eat out of garbage cans. I work for food. I'm a Vietnam combat vet. Now we're seeing signs I'm a Persian Gulf vet. So it's like a repetition of similar horrors that occurred almost 25, 30 years ago.
I saw one astounding figure about people in shelters, and it said something like, and homeless people on the street. What is the figure, the percentage of them who are veterans?
In the city of New York, on any given night, depending on what percentage of statistics that you take, 35% of the homeless population is consistent with veterans. That could be anywhere from 90,000 to 120,000 people are homeless on a given night. The homeless veteran situation got so bad about 8 or 9 years ago, we approached city, state, and federal government, and we encouraged them to open up a veteran shelter specifically for veterans, because that's how bad it was. It's called the Borton Avenue Men's Residence in Long Island City, Queens. They only have, I think, a bed level of 425, and that's nothing. That's like a dip in the bucket.
Today, you're working at Black Veterans for Social Justice as the deputy director, but you struggled when you came back from Vietnam. What happened to you?
I came home. I was disillusioned. I lived in Bedford-Stuyvesant. By the time I got home, my block was devastated. A lot of my peers ended up in prison, substance abuse, alcoholism. I thought that I would come home and a wealth of benefits would help me go through my transitionary period. That didn't happen. I fell victim to a lot of the ills in the system and in the streets. And when I went to the VA, they tried to assist me, but they gave me a 14-day detoxification program. And then on the day of my release, they gave me a token and told me goodbye. And what happened was I left, hit the streets again, and I ended up again and again. And then one day I was walking down Fulton Street and I saw this sign. It said, Black Veterans for Social Justice. And I felt that I'd found a home. I mean, I needed to talk to people that were like me, people that could understand my problem. We have another term, it's called the continuum of care. You have to have a continuum of care in order to service people. You just can't give them a hand and then don't continue to try to support and hold them. And that's what I did not get. So I've been working with the Black Vets for 12 years now, and I feel healed. I'm giving something back to my community. I mean, I came on the show yesterday, and I got back to my office at about 11:30. I had about 10 or 15 calls, and all during the course of the day we were besieged. Family members, friends, people who are on reserve status, National Guard status, people are really concerned. What is going to happen to my life? And a lot of people don't know what happens to veterans when they come home. They really don't know. They just see the little micro shots of people, I'm willing to go to war, I'm happy, we need to do something, but that's only a little fraction. They don't show the people that are frustrated, the people that are scared, the people that actually don't want to be there. That part of the story is never shown.
What about that? I mean, they're calling up reservists now. People might say, listen, you join the military or you join the National Guard. This is what your responsibility is.
Well, in 1991, when we did the first strikes, we ended up opening our offices almost 12 to 14 hours a day. A lot of people decided to go AWOL. A lot of people decided to claim conscientious objector status because, as I said earlier, a lot of people enter the reserves and the military and the National Guard based upon economic need. It's not a patriotic duty to serve your country. These people are joining the military because they have a lack of other ways of getting economic stability. And then when the reality comes that you may have to be forced to go to war, then they are woken up, and it's like, I really don't want to be in the business of killing people and destroying people's lives, because that's the reality.
Isn't college education a major part of wanting to join the reserves?
That's true, but if you really look at the facts with the Montgomery GI Bill, you have to serve a certain percentage of time in the military in order to become eligible for that. If you don't serve 24 months, you don't become eligible for the $40,000. So you can serve 18 months of time, get released, and you have no eligibility for the educational benefits whatsoever. So to be all you can be, a lot of the encouragement that they're giving to young people to join the military is really ludicrous, and it's not realistic.
What do you tell people who are thinking of joining the military today?
Personally, I discourage young people from joining the military. The military complex and the military, in fact, is an institution that is designed to kill and to destroy people. It's not the uniforms and the medals and the pretty pictures when you see the commercials. The reality is that it's an institution that is designed to kill and hurt people. And I discourage young people from that. If they do go, I try to have them make good choices. A lot of people cannot handle the discipline of the military. And bad conduct discharges or bad paper discharges, undesirable discharges, dishonorable discharges are disproportionately given to people of color. And unlike other institutions, the military getting a dishonorable discharge can follow you for the rest of your life. It's not like I go to CBS and I work and I quit, goodbye, you know, it's over with. And the military, that can follow you to the day that you die. So you can have a scar.
Steve Williams, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Stephen Williams, Deputy Director of Black Veterans for Social Justice. Your phone number, where people can call.
We're at 718-935-1116. And we are encouraging people to join us in Washington, D.C. on May the 30th, Memorial Day. We want to have a Memorial Day for all veterans of all wars, the Iraqis, Iranians, whoever's a veteran internationally. And if you can't afford to come, call us at 718-852-6004. Ask for Mrs. Wendy McClinton. And if you can't get the money, we'll sponsor you and make sure that you get a seat.
Well, thank you very much. And again, the phone number for Black Veterans for Social Justice, 718-935-1116. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Our email address, democracy@pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, Hisuku, Jeremy Scahill, Errol Maitland engineered. Thanks to Michelle Garcia. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.